Every decade leaves a mark on the ones that follow, but perhaps no decade has been as influential in the lives of current Americans as the 1960s. Just a really short list, civil rights, Vietnam War, moon landing, illustrates the level of the events in those years. Our next guest focuses on the period from August 1969 to August 1970 as the crescendo of the 60s in her book, Witness to the Revolution. Clara Bingham is the author. She's a former White House correspondent for Newsweek, with articles published in a long list of other magazines. She has written or co-written two other books, including one on women in Congress, and Clara has also produced the documentary film The Last Mountain. Clara Bingham, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
I'm guessing from your dust jacket photo you do not remember this time that well yourself. What got you into this?
That's nice of you to say. I actually was born, I have to reveal my real age, in 1963. So I, as I say in the book, I missed the party, but only by about 15 years. And when I graduated from college in 1985, at the sort of height of the Reagan administration, I realized that just 15 years earlier, the largest student strike in America had taken place in May of 1970, and that because of all of the social and cultural changes that went on in the 60s, my life as a female college graduate was really radically different than it would have been, say, 20 years ago. So I was close enough to that time of profound change to be really curious about it, and I wanted to make what I called a intergenerational exploration into what it was really like for the people who were activists back then.
And you do talk to people who were young and in college at the time and people who were older than that, and all sorts of interviews in here. The period you've chosen, August 1969 to August 1970, did you fix on the period from the interviews, or did the interviews, did you base the interviews on the period?
A good question. I actually decided to pick that period, and then I based the interviews on it. And I thought that 1968 had been written about extensively. That was a really traumatic year when Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated, and the Vietnam War started becoming more and more unpopular, and the Tet Offensive occurred, and which was considered a military loss to some extent for the Americans. And so that year had been well documented, and then, of course, you know, leading up to Watergate in the mid-early 70s, that also was a period of time that was well documented. But the last 2 years of the 60s haven't gotten quite as much attention. I think they're really important years to look at because, as you said in your introduction, they were the crescendo of the 60s. It was a time when everything bubbled in together. There was kind of a perfect storm between the Cultural Revolution and the Political Revolution and the anti-war movement. And it all kind of exploded together, beginning with Woodstock in August of 69 and going all the way through the Chicago 7 trial, the two moratoriums to end the Vietnam War, which were in October and November of 69, the assassination of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton in December, the weathermen bombed the townhouse in Greenwich Village, and three of them were killed in March. The administration announced that they were invading Cambodia. May 1 of 70, four students were killed in Kent State just 3 days later. And then there was a massive student strike that I just mentioned where 2.5 million college students refused to go to classes and take final exams, shutting down 700 colleges across the country.
So a lot that happened back then, a lot that affected many people's lives. You only have to look at a picture or two, particularly the one of the woman bent over the bodies of the people who were shot dead at Kent State, to realize how strongly things were felt then. I'm struck by how many of the interviewees you got here still feel those emotions strongly.
Yeah, it was one of the reasons why I decided to do an oral history. This is an oral history narrative, so everything is in first-person voice. And I only chime in with introductions and footnotes and, give the book some glue. But otherwise, it all comes directly, from the words of the people I interviewed. And it makes it very emotionally authentic. And you can sort of palpably sense how strongly everyone felt about those times and what happened to them and how much their lives are changed by it.
And one of the things, too, is actually a set of numbers about emotion that indicate how quickly American opinion flipped from hawkish to dovish. That was a very fast transition, wasn't it?
Yeah, it would all, you know, in 1969, 68, a majority of the country was still for the, you know, pro-war and thought we were doing the right thing in Vietnam. And by 69, that changed, and over 50% were against the war. And in terms of students at that stage, 70% of all students were against the war, which is a very high percentage. So by 69, the switch from 68 to 70 really caused major change in public opinion in America. And the other thing that started happening by 1970 is a lot of soldiers were coming home from the war, and many of them were disillusioned with what was going on over there, realized it was unwinnable, and became very important parts of the anti-war movement, the Vietnam vets against the war.
Did you or any of the people you interviewed have any difficulty using the term revolution?
Yeah, I mean, it was a much debated term, and I think that, in fact, many of them, when I said, what was it like for you in the revolution, they said, well, we tried to have a revolution, but it didn't work, and which is, you know, right. I used that word broadly in my title to really show that it was, there was an attempt at a political revolution, but that didn't take place. But there was a lot going on in terms of social change that really was, you could call a revolution to some extent, with the culture, you know, the culture wars that were going on at the time.
Clara Bingham's book is called Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul, August 1969 to August 1970, through the number of different voices. We'll come back and talk more with Clara and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Journalist Clara Bingham is our guest today. She has put together a book that is largely interviews. It's an oral history from people who lived through the period of the 1960s called Witness to the Revolution. She focuses on the period August 1969 to August 1970, which, as she puts it, is the crescendo of the 1960s. Join us on the Exchange. You have some perceptions of that time yourself. We'd like to hear them. 800-838-3760 by phone, email address jx@jeffnet.org. Clara, is it fair to say the coming of age of the baby boomers was a huge part of the events of that time?
Yes. I mean, there were a massive amount of kids in college at that stage, the largest ever. So that the baby boomers had a lot of power in terms of numbers. And they created this huge cohort. So when they all made a decision, you know, not in unison, obviously, but when a majority of them felt a certain way politically, it obviously had a strong ripple effect. And you add to that the draft. 27 million young American men were affected by the draft between 1965 and 1973, and that was extremely politicizing.
David Harris is one of the people you follow in a chapter about the draft. He's a Stanford student. He headed for Freedom Summer in Mississippi. To do what?
Well, he like a lot of the anti-war organizers later in the 60s, learned how to organize during the civil rights movement. And he went down in 64 to help black voters register to vote. And, no one was registered to vote down in the Deep South because of extreme racism and segregation. So a lot of college students, white college students from the, you know, California and the Northeast went down there and, organized. And it was a very eye-opening experience for them and also very politicizing. So went by 1965 when Harris was at Stanford and later became the student president, he felt that the best way to resist the war politically was to go to jail. And instead of fleeing to California, he thought if everybody refused the draft and just decided that they would have to go to jail for 2 years the way he did, it would be a very, effective way of fighting fighting the war at home.
You know, he was certainly known at that time in the 60s and 70s. Was married to Joan Baez. Went to jail. Before that, though, he got a haircut on campus at Stanford. From whom?
The fraternity. He was kidnapped by some fraternity brothers, and they shaved his head, forcibly tied him down and forcibly shaved his head, which was then written about in the Stanford paper and the San Francisco papers. And this was and it actually increased Harris's popularity. And this is something that happened a lot. Long hair was considered very threatening by the 1950s conservative status quo. And so I talked to several people who were hippies at that time and had forcibly had their heads shaved. And for example, in Wisconsin, I focus a lot on the University of Wisconsin, which was a very radical campus and very violent. And the police force, when they would arrest, have big mass arrests of kids who were protesting, would shave all their heads the second they came in. They would take a mugshot, take their fingerprints, and shave their heads.
There was a county in Oregon, Curry County, that the sheriff in the 70s would pick up people with long hair and bring them to the jail and shave their heads and take them to the county line and let them go.
Yep. It's hard to imagine. It's really, really hard to imagine now that something just as small as having long hair could have been so threatening. And in fact, I quote the 1969 film Easy Rider. Mm-hmm. When Dennis Hopper's character Billy is talking to George, and George says they're scared of what you represent to them, and Billy says all we represent to them is someone who needs a haircut, and then George says what you represent to them is freedom, and Billy says what the hell is wrong with freedom? That's what it's all about. And George said, that's what it's all about, all right, but talking about it and being it, that's two different things. It's real hard to be free when you're bought and sold in the marketplace. When they see a free individual, it's going to scare them. It makes them dangerous.
It's a well-chosen quote from Easy Rider. In witness to the revolution, radicals, resistors, vets, hippies, and the year America lost its mind and found its soul. Clara Bingham is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You're talking about Madison. I was rather surprised to recollect that it was Madison that was really the hotbed of campus activity, less than Berkeley or Columbia.
I know. I mean, we think, of course, Berkeley and Columbia are so high profile, and they, of course, experienced a huge amount of turmoil and early protests. But Madison also was a hotbed of lefty radicalism, and the National Guard was, practically going to class. They were there so often, and there were a lot of students that were not from Wisconsin who went to school there. They were from the Northeast. And they were just very, very committed and against the war. And there were early protests there because Dow Chemical, there was a lot of research that Dow Chemical subsidized at the university. And Dow Chemical was the maker of napalm, which was used in Vietnam. And so there were a lot of protests early on against Dow. And then in the very end, the university, everyone knew about it in August of 1970 when a small group of anti-war rebels blew up the Army math building, the building where this research was taking place, and literally destroyed an entire building and by mistake killed a young researcher who was working at, at 2 a.m. So it was one of the biggest acts of domestic terrorism at the time. And, this group of four men became fugitives and three of them were found. Actually, one never was found. So that was considered in some ways the end of the anti-war, movement when that bomb took place because it was so tragic and extreme.
Well, that was where the question was going next, was when you talk to the once student protesters, what do they make of how violent things ended up getting?
Well, basically the sense I got is that the violence really hurt the cause. And that it alienated a lot of Americans who might have been against the war but didn't want to affiliate themselves with violent people, and that it was actually hypocritical in a lot of ways to be involved in what was considered the peace movement, to be anti-war, but at the same time to be conducting your own personal war against the government. So that was the general, and most of the activists I talked to who were involved in more militant groups do regret the violence that took place. But at the same time, they explained why they did what they did. They felt very strongly that the war was a terrible thing, that the government was not listening to them, that they could stage these massive protests. I mean, the first moratorium against the war, 2 million people participated all over the country. And then after that, a month later, 500,000 people came to D.C. And so protest after protest, year after year, didn't change anything. And so there was a level of frustration that's by the end of the 60s, it was very, very high.
One of the people you talked to was Bill Ayers, who, of course, is a hate target for today's right. They tried to tie President Obama to him in both campaigns. What are his memories about the birth of the Weathermen?
He was very interesting in terms of talking about how they split off from the Students for the Democratic Society. That was the group that they were part of, and it was a massive, there are over 100,000 members, student organization that was against the war, pro-civil rights organization. And by 1969, it became very political, and there were different communist factions within the group. And the Weathermen split off from the rest of SDS and formed their own band of militant, anti-war activists. And initially, they wanted to bomb and kill people and hurt people. And they were building a bomb in a Greenwich Village townhouse that exploded by mistake, killing three members of the Weathermen. And after that tragedy, they regrouped and changed their strategy to bombing light, where they would bomb symbolic places, banks, police departments, police cars. Eventually, they even got into the Pentagon and the Capitol, but without at times of day when they knew no one would be there and they wouldn't hurt anybody.
Clara Bingham's our guest on The Exchange. Her book about the late 60s is Witness to the Revolution. You can't talk about the groups at that time, Weathermen included, without talking about COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI. How successful was that, if at all?
Well, I mean, it's really, that was one of the big surprises for me when I started working on this book. I didn't realize the extent of what the FBI was doing at the time. And they had a massive kind of secret police, run by Herbert Hoover, who was the director of the FBI under six presidents. So he had, a huge amount of power, and it went largely unchecked. But he considered the anti-war movement and the Black Power movement to be enemy number one and two. And he had a secret organization inside the FBI that spied on all of these groups, disrupted them, tried to infiltrate them, and no one knew about it until it was discovered in 1971 in Media, Pennsylvania, when a group of anti-war activists broke into an FBI office and found these secret files of what was called COINTELPRO.
Speaking of secret files, Daniel Ellsberg is one of the people you talked to. Tell us about what activated him, what got him switched on to become so powerfully anti-war.
He was such a fascinating story, and he started out as a pro-war defense, hawk, and he worked for the Defense Department, and he worked for the RAND think tank as a military contractor, and then he went to Vietnam himself, worked for the State Department there for a year and went into the field and really studied what was going on. And he came to the conclusion that the war was unwinnable and that we were making a mistake and that the Vietnamese felt so strongly about their independence and that they would not back down. and that we could just keep on sending troops over and we would never ultimately win the war, and it was futile. So he came back from Vietnam a changed person, and it wasn't until he went to a conference, a peace conference, in August of 1969 and heard a man named Randy Keeler give an impassioned speech about how he was planning to go to jail to resist the draft, and he was part of David Harris's group, the Resistance. And he was one of the last men left in his off at the Resistance offices in San Francisco because they were all in jail at that stage. And Ellsberg was had an epiphany, and he realized if this kid who had, you know, was had gone to just graduated from Harvard and had so much promise, was so intelligent and successful, if the best thing he could do for his country that he believed he could do for his country was go to jail, then Ellsberg thought that he should do whatever he personally could do to end the war. And he had written a chapter in something called the Pentagon Papers, which is a 7,000-page, you know, encyclopedic study of the history of America's involvement in Vietnam up until that point. And he started Xeroxing those papers and eventually was able to release them to the press.
Well, you know, I was about to ask the question about what did the Nixon administration do with the information they got from Morton Halperin and the other people who prepared the report. The short answer should be that that one of the things that the Dirty Tricks gang of the Watergate era was trying to do was break into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist and get the records on him to try to discredit him. How much dissent was there even within the Nixon administration from what you found out in your interviews?
Well, there was a lot. I mean, I interviewed several people who worked in the national security staff for Kissinger, and they all resigned after the invasion of Cambodia. And there were a lot of people who were trying from the inside. To Roger Morris, Tony Lake, and Morton Halperin, or the three of them, who were trying from the inside to change policy, and then when they realized that they weren't being listened to, they resigned.
While we're talking about Richard Nixon, let's talk about his use of the term silent majority. What did he mean, and was it actually a majority from what anybody could figure out?
Well, it's hard to tell if it was a majority, but he certainly did get reelected in a landslide in 1972. So there certainly was a counter-revolution going on at the same time that there was a left revolution going on. And a lot of the rhetoric and activities of the anti-war movement was so extreme and to the left that it did alienate a large amount of Americans who thought that they were crazy hippies and they were unpatriotic. And so Nixon really took on the anti-war movement. And when he gave the speech on November 3rd and coined the phrase, the silent majority, and he said, you know, the loud minority essentially is not with me. And he wanted to denigrate the anti-war movement and make them look as if they were a fringe group and they weren't, you know, that they didn't really represent a large segment of the population, which in fact they really did. And there were a lot of moderates, mostly moderates, who were against the war at that stage. Many members of Congress and the Senate, and as well as, of course, the young hippies. So by telling the rest of America that the silent majority was with him, he was using this, it became a catchphrase that that represented the white working class patriotic Americans. And a few days after Kent State, there was something called the Hard Hat Riot, which some people think the Nixon administration actually, and the plumbers and all of his Dirty Tricks guys, might have even staged. And when 200 construction workers attacked a group of anti-war protesters in Wall Street a few days after the Kent State massacre and just beat them to a pulp, and the cops stood by and watched. And Nixon had them all come to the White House afterwards to congratulate them.
Wow. Of the activists and protesters from that time, do they speak wistfully about that time as if they wish there really had been a revolution, as if things had changed more profoundly than they did?
Yeah, I think there's the sense I got is that the political revolution lost and the cultural revolution won. And the politicos, the lefties, who really were hoping for more economic equality and corporations that were regulated and weren't in charge of our political system, they really felt that they lost that war, and that in a way that, you know, the Bernie revolution, Bernie Sanders stands for that point of view.
Okay, I was hoping you'd tie those together, and you did. The book is called Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. Clara Bingham wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Clara, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.